This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Okay, it's been a long time. You, me, Checker. This is fun. It's like one of our senior staff meetings.
It is.
It's not half as much fun as our senior staff meeting. Well,
now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the wild thing of the education policy debate, Checker Finn.
Gadfly in chief. Well, glad to be here.
Yes. Sad this week, Maurice Sendak passing away. What's your favorite Maurice Sendak story?
Where the wild things are, of course.
Oh, yeah?
Yes. If we're going to be wild things, let's go with the inventor.
Let the wild rumpus begin. My favorite that we've been enjoying reading with our boys is In the Night Kitchen. Did you read that one as well?
I don't remember it right now.
Right.
I'm sure I've read it to somebody once upon a time.
I'm in the milk, and the milk's not me. I'm Mickey. Anyway, you should all check it out. If you know, everybody knows where the wild things are, but you may not know In the Night Kitchen. It also won the Caldecott, I believe, and it's very good and fun.
Well, we will miss him, but he left a legacy.
Yes. Okay, so Checker, lots to cover today in the world of education reform. We're going to play Pardon the Gadfly, and then Amber will come here and steal the show with her Research Minute, as she does every week.
She always does.
One more announcement to our listeners. Checker is on the show, and Checker, we have a big announcement because we've told our listeners before that we were contemplating ending the podcast, which has now been on the air for 6 years. And we are here to say that the podcast shall live for 6 years more, or at least for now.
The podcast certainly has a reprieve, yes. And may it put it to good use.
Yes, and I really do appreciate and heard from a lot of you about the value you find in this. Please continue to tell your friends and family about it. You will be surprised. People you think must be listening to this show have never heard of it. And make sure that changes.
Otherwise, we're going to sell it to Bain Capital for a turnaround.
Okay. I thought Murdoch was the one we're talking about.
Ah, Murdoch. Yes. Either one will do.
Okay. Let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
Last week, California announced it would ask the Department of Education for a waiver from some provisions of NCLB, but wouldn't meet Arne Duncan's conditions. Is this going to be a big election year battle?
What do you think, Checker? You know, this is interesting. You've got a Democratic governor, a Democratic state superintendent, as far as I know, a Democratic state board chair, all thumbing their noses at the Democratic Secretary of Education.
I think the White House is going to tell the Secretary of Education to cave, just as they once upon a time did in the Al Gore, George W. Bush election, a previous White House. I think they're going to say, don't harass any prominent state with federal micromanagement at a time when we don't want to look like micromanagers.
But this does really put the administration in a quandary, because if they did that, basically what California is saying is, forget your whole waiver process that you've announced. We're going to just go by the book and apply for a waiver as it's described in the law, and we're not going to meet conditions. Especially, we are not going to do a statewide teacher evaluation system because we can't afford it. And they are almost daring the department to say no, because if they said no, California probably could sue and say that they have no grounds to turn down this waiver, and it could be a big fiasco. Now, if the administration, as you say, Checker, bends to the political winds and says yes, every other state in the land is going to say, hey, forget this other waiver process. We just want to do what California did.
I just think in an election year, they will find a face-saving compromise that will enable both California and the Department of Education to say it came out okay.
Okay. Topic number two.
Checker, you recently returned from observing gifted education programs in Japan and Singapore. How do these countries educate their high flyers differently than the U.S.?
In 90 seconds or less.
I can't even clear my throat in 90 seconds or less. Singapore has a very purposeful human capital development strategy that starts with a 1% gifted education program in the upper elementary grades and goes into pretty special high schools for smart kids and high achievers, mostly exam-based. Japan denies that it has a gifted education program, and as far as I can tell, at the elementary level, they actually don't have one, but they do have selective admission high schools, so they have a kind of de facto secondary school, elite or gifted education program for kids who get high test scores.
But I understand that in Japan, if many of the gifted kids, the high-achieving kids, go to private schools.
In Tokyo, more than half of all high school kids go to private school, not just the gifted kids. And the some of the private schools in Tokyo, I'm not sure this is true all over Japan, some of the private schools in Tokyo regard themselves as the refuge for gifted kids from a state education system that does a pretty good job in the average case, but doesn't do much special for smart kids.
And what about, there's a school in Singapore, I understand, modeled on Virginia's Thomas Jefferson High School.
Absolutely. A senior minister in the Singapore government came to see TJ in Fairfax County, Virginia, and liked what he saw and said, we need one of those in Singapore. And now they've got one. They're very organized, slightly scary how organized they are, country.
You know, we've for a long time been exporting bad education ideas around the world. It's good that we actually export some good ideas every once in a while as well.
We need more exports, and it will do wonders for our balance of trade.
Okay, topic number three.
On Monday, J.P. Green wrote a guest blog post for Fordham arguing the key to improving education governance is increasing parental choice, not creating a more centralized system. Is he right?
He's partly right. Empowering parents and giving them choices is part of the change that is needed in American education, but so is having a coherent set of standards and measures and comparisons and transparencies and accountability, and not just trusting to the parent marketplace to make everything come out fine. We need a balance of centralized and decentralized. Our current system does a good job of neither. So Jay is half right, as he almost always is.
So, I mean, in my opinion, I think Jay's onto something here. I mean, my own view is that we need to have two separate systems. Okay, we have one system that's for the bulk of the schools, especially in the suburbs and small towns, where school choice is never going to be a big factor, other than maybe digital learning, and you know, most of whom belong to these tiny little school districts that are never going to have the capacity to do things around curriculum development and professional development and all of that well, and find a way for those schools to be part of something bigger that is more coherent. Maybe it's not another governance structure, but maybe it's some kind of collaborative group that they join that can do a lot of that that curriculum development and alignment work for them, and they can do it together. Separately, in the big cities where there's just more people and in closer proximity, you can create a real marketplace of schools and try to make that bottom-up model work as best as possible. And I think where we've been wrong, Checker, is in sometimes trying to combine the two in saying that we want every school, for example, to have the autonomy that a charter school has. Well, yes or no. I mean, if you have a system that's got a lot of school principals that aren't particularly entrepreneurial, or you've got parents who aren't necessarily wanting something that's all that different from one school to the next, it may not make sense to try to treat every charter school as a charter school. You more or less say, hey, you know, we want to make sure that you go into an Applebee's and it looks pretty much the same as the Applebee's in the town over, and you're okay with that. And you just want to make sure the quality is reasonably good, that may be the model for a lot of our schools.
Yeah, I think you're trying to have it both ways and coming up with something that's neither or isn't going to meld very well. The part of your plan that involves the individual small schools banding together voluntarily for economies of scale and shared services and things like that is fine. That empowers the school to decide when it can do something solo and when it needs to team up with something larger. And as long as the school and the school community are making that decision, I'm fine with this. It's the top-down system deciding for the school what the school ought to do and or forcing it to do that that I've got misgivings about. It's, of course, true that some principals are not ready to be CEOs, but as long as we treat them as bureaucrats, they're not going to become CEOs, nor are we going to find people that want to be CEOs to run those schools.
You know, the other thing that Jay argues is that we're being naive about the tight, loose talk that we have, that if you are tight on what kids are supposed to learn via standards, and if you really start to drive those standards via teacher evaluations, through course exams, and the like, then we're not being honest about the degree of autonomy that schools have. We like to say, look, set the standards, have the assessments, the schools can get there any way they like. But if you get more specific about what's on those tests and what's in the standards, and then it starts to say that, well, actually, you don't have a whole wide range of motion as a school. You actually have to do things pretty particular way if you want to have a shot at getting those kinds of results.
Well, you're at least partly right about that naivete, but Jay is naive about how parent markets work, as if it's going to lead to quality control and good standards and great teaching and lots of learning. And we've seen far too many examples already of situations where there is a parent marketplace, where parents are satisfied with sort of vendor claims or low achievement or other things that are really not in their own kids' interest and certainly not in the public interest.
Okay, that's all the time we've got for Pardon the Gadfly. Thanks for playing Checkered. Thank you, Ty. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Mike. How you doing?
Good. It's been a long time. You, me, Checkered. Boy, this is fun. It's like one of our senior staff meetings.
It is.
It's not half as much fun as our senior staff meetings.
Well, that is true.
We get to tell dirty jokes and do all these things we can't do on the air.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Checker's always a perfect gentleman. He gives Amber his jacket to wear because
yes,
he likes to keep his room at about the same temperature as a meat locker.
Yes, frigid air.
Well, it's not my fault that Amber has the body temperature of a chameleon.
Yeah, you come in my office, it's like heater. But anyway.
Okay, what you got for us this week,
A new study out this week by Bill Smith. He examines what he calls congruence between states' previous math standards and the Common Core. He compares how students from each state fared on the 2008 NAEP exam. Basically, we've seen some of this research before. He finds that the topics covered in high-achieving countries largely map onto the CCSS math standards in terms of similar topics and grade-level coverage.
You're saying the Common Core math standards.
Yes, Common Core math standards.
Yeah.
CCSS, our listeners know that. He also finds that states with standards that were more similar to the Common Core and with high cut scores did better on NAEP than those states with standards that were substantially different from the Common Core. He cautions that these results will not in and of themselves elevate student performance. So I just want to say these cautions are important. There's a few problems with the research brief. First, it's just that. We don't have the actual study yet, so there are many unanswered questions. Second, as Bill Evers, no fan of the Common Core, rightly points out, the mapping diagram where they show the standards between the high-achieving countries and the Common Core, it's not a perfect match, but the visual in the report kind of makes it appear to be a perfect match.
Mm-hmm.
He also shows us that the number of topics covered in the core and the average state standards. He kind of goes through the how many topics the core has, how many topics average state standards has. Like, it's supposed to illustrate fewer, but the totals aren't that far off. They're only off by a few topics, so I wasn't quite sure what that was supposed to be demonstrating. And finally, though, the cut scores can be proxies for raising expectations. They don't ensure high-quality standards, so it wasn't clear what the cut scores were supposed to be saying about congruence. Still in all, I think at the end of the day, it's showing that there's a congruence here. It's not perfect. It's a significant overlap, and presumably that's a huge improvement from what we've had before and reason to try to get these implemented right. That's where I'm going to end up with that.
Wow. All right. So I certainly understand this idea of mapping the content from one to another, and that's helpful. But then going to the NAEP, this seems like a little bit of a bigger leap. Was he just looking at one point in time NAEP scores?
2009.
This wasn't saying states that have improved more or that.
That's
all right. So we all know that there's a million reasons why those states might have higher NAEP scores than the others. I mean, how does he try to make that link?
He's trying to say, so if you look at the mapping, Massachusetts ends up in the middle. Right? And California ends up on the top. So then you're left like with, okay, what do we do about Massachusetts, right? So then he looks at the cut scores, you know, and kind of factors that in.
Okay.
And then you're able to say, okay, well, that's the additional reason why a state like Massachusetts is doing better. So.
But what about California, which also has a high cut score?
Yeah, that's the big question.
Gotcha. So California is the outlier,
right.
Which is the case in other, right? I mean, we know this. I mean, California has great standards. They have a high cut score, and yet achievement stinks in California. They've made little progress. And so you say, look, there's all this other stuff happening too. Their schools have been vastly underfunded. There's total churn in the policy environment. The governance is a mess. So the standards-based reform stuff can only go so far in a state that's screwed up in other ways.
Right. Dysfunctional.
I mean, how would you read this, Checker?
As Bill Schmidt trying to encourage the Common Core to be kept and embraced and taken seriously, which he has long been in favor of, and it's a legitimate thing to be in favor of. I think we are in agreement here at Fordham that if the Common Core standards are properly implemented and then embedded in a proper measurement and accountability system, they are likely to do some kids some good, including in a bunch of states that haven't done this very well on their own up to this point. But is that just the standards at work, or is that the implementation at work? California is notorious for having good standards and bad implementation, and for a whole variety of reasons, including budget and all that, class size requirements and so on. So I think good standards well implemented are better than bad standards well implemented. What we tend to lack here are both good standards and good implementation, where our fingers are crossed that the Common Core is going to turn out to be the exception to that.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and there's some other sort of survey research. He says, you know, most teachers are comfortable and they feel like they're going to be able to teach the Common Core, which you can sort of spin either way, right? Like, oh no, how can they be comfortable if these are so different? Or, hey, maybe we've got really highly qualified teachers that are, you know, feeling about, who knows? But yeah, I mean, I think there are more questions than we have answers at this point. Still early in the game.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, you know, there are all these debates on the math side and on the English side. In English, there's been debates about fiction versus nonfiction, pre-reading. Mm-hmm. In the math side, all these debates about whether the high school Common Core standards are tough enough or as good as these other ones. Mm-hmm. I wonder, would you say, is at this point, are the debates louder and more vociferous on the math side or the English side? Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I was going to point out that the Common Core standards do not incorporate a cut score of any kind. That remains to be seen when the assessments come along.
Right.
You could have great Common Core standards and a low cut score yielding nothing, actually.
Yeah. Right. Which is something he doesn't get into in this, which we need to get into that.
All right. And later this week, Common Science Standards, not Common Core Science Standards, but Common Science Standards.
Next century science
next
standards.
Generation.
Sorry,
next
generation.
Will
Millennium,
be coming out.
Whatever.
And perhaps all the energy will go into fighting over science.
There we go.
Okay. That's all the time we've got for this week. Until next week.
I'm Checker Finn.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.